of the Pasteur Institute read his paper summarizing experiments with diphtheria antitoxin before the International Congress on Hygiene in Budapest. Many of the greatest scientists in the world sat in the audience. As Rouve finished, these men, each renowned in his own right, began to clap, then stood on their seats, their hands making thunderous sounds, their voices shouting applause in half a dozen languages, their hats thrown to the ceiling. Welch then reported American experiences confirming the work of both the French and Germans. And each delegate returned to his home with a bottle of this marvelous curative agent in his possession. In the keynote speech at the next meeting of the Association of American Physicians, an association created to foster scientific medicine, Welch said, "The discovery of the healing serum is entirely the result of laboratory work. In no sense was the discovery an accidental one. Every step leading to it can be traced, and every step was taken with a definite purpose and to solve a definite problem. These studies and resulting discoveries mark an epoch in the history of medicine." His comment was a declaration not of war, but of victory. Scientific medicine had developed technologies that could both prevent and cure diseases that had previously killed in huge numbers, and killed gruesomely. And if French and German scientists had found the antitoxin, Americans William Park, chief of the laboratory division of the New York City Health Department, and Anna Williams, his deputy and perhaps the leading female bacteriologist in this country, possibly anywhere, transformed it into something that every doctor in the developed world had easy access to. They were an odd couple. He with an original and creative mind, but staid, even stolid, extremely precise and well-organized. She, wild, risk-taking, intensely curious, a woman who took new inventions apart to see how they worked. They complemented each other perfectly. In 1894, they discovered a way to make a toxin 500 times as potent as that used by Europeans. This lethality made a far more efficient stimulator of antitoxin and slashed the cost to one-tenth what it had been. Park then broke the production process into tasks that ordinary workers, not scientists, could perform, and turned part of the laboratory into a virtual factory. It soon became by far the cheapest, most efficient, and reliable producer of the antitoxin in the world. Diphtheria antitoxin production today is still based on their methods. The lab distributed it free in New York and sold it elsewhere. Park used the money to subsidize basic research and make the city laboratories into arguably the best medical research institution in the country at the time. Its annual reports soon contained, according to one historian of medicine, a body of research of which any institute in the world would be proud. And the antitoxin suddenly became available around the world. Diphtheria fatality rates quickly fell by almost two-thirds, and country doctors began to perform miracles. It was only the first miracle of what promised to be many. As the use of this antitoxin was becoming widespread, Frederick Gates, an intellectually curious Baptist minister who had a gift for seeing opportunities to exploit and was an assistant to John D. Rockefeller, picked up a medical textbook written by William Osler called The Principles and Practice of Medicine, a textbook that would go through many editions and find a readership among both physicians and informed laymen. In it, Osler traced the evolution of medical ideas, explored controversies, and, most significantly, admitted uncertainty and ignorance. Gates had started working for Rockefeller as a philanthropic advisor, but nothing limited him to eleemosynary concerns. He organized several Rockefeller business ventures, pulling, for example, a $50 million profit out of the Mesabi Iron Range in Minnesota. Rockefeller himself used a homeopathic physician, and Gates had also read the New Testament of Homeopathic Medicine, written by Samuel Hahnemann, founder of the movement. Gates decided that Hahnemann must have been, to speak charitably, little less than lunatic. Osler's book impressed Gates in very different ways, for it presented a paradox. First, it showed that medical science had immense promise. But it also showed that that promise was far from being realized. It became clear to me that medicine could hardly hope to become a science, Gates explained, until qualified men could give themselves to uninterrupted study and investigation, on ample salary, entirely independent of practice. Here was an opportunity, to me the greatest, which the world could afford for Mr. Rockefeller to become a pioneer. Meanwhile, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. talked about the idea of funding medical research with two prominent physicians, L. Emmett Holt and Christian Herter, both former students of Welch. Both eagerly endorsed the idea. On January 2, 1901, Rockefeller Sr.'s grandchild, John Rockefeller McCormick, also the grandchild of Cyrus McCormick, died of scarlet fever in Chicago. Later that year, the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research was incorporated. It would change everything. Welch declined the offer to head the new institute, but he assumed all the duties of launching it, chairing both the institute board itself and its board of scientific directors. That scientific board included Welch's old friend, T. Mitchell Pruden, Holt, Herter, two other prominent scientists who had been students of Welch, and Harvard's Theobald Smith. Smith, one of the leading bacteriologists in the world, had been Welch's first choice for director, but had declined because he had done most of his research on animal diseases. For example, developing a vaccine to prevent hog cholera, and thought it would be more politic to have a director who had investigated human disease. So Welch offered the position to Simon Flexner, who had left the Hopkins to take a highly prestigious professorship at the University of Pennsylvania's medical school. Flexner had rejected an offer of an $8,000 salary from Cornell to take the position at Penn at $5,000. But his appointment had been contentious, and at the meeting where he was chosen, one faculty member said that accepting the Jew as a professor did not involve accepting him as a man. Daily, he fought with other faculty over both personal and substantive issues. Flexner accepted Welch's offer and a raise. But the launching of the institute remained firmly under Welch's control. In this, Flexner said, Welch accepted no assistance, not even clerical. Every detail was attended to with his own hand, every letter handwritten. The European research institutes were either dedicated to infectious disease or designed to allow freedom to individuals such as Pasteur, Koch, and Ehrlich. The Rockefeller Institute saw medicine itself as its field. From its earliest existence, scientists there studied infectious disease, but they also laid the groundwork in surgery for organ transplants, established links between viruses and cancer, and developed a method to store blood. At first, the Institute gave modest grants to scientists elsewhere, but in 1903, it opened its own laboratory. In 1910, its own hospital. And Flexner began to come into his own. There was a roughness about Simon Flexner, something left over from the streets, from his growing up the black sheep in an immigrant Jewish family in Louisville, Kentucky. Older and younger brothers were brilliant students, but he quit school in the sixth grade. Sullen and flirting with delinquency, he was fired even by an uncle from a menial job in a photography studio. Next, he worked for a dry goods dealer who defrauded people and fled the city. A druggist fired him. His father gave him a tour of the city jail to try to frighten him into obedience, then arranged a plumbing apprenticeship. But the plumber balked when Simon's old principal warned him not to have anything to do with Simon Flexner. At the age of 19, Flexner got another job with a druggist, washing bottles. The shop had a microscope, and the druggist forbade him to touch it. He ignored the order. Flexner hated any kind of tedium and taking orders. What the microscope showed him was not at all tedious. Abruptly, his mind engaged. He was fascinated. He began making sudden, impossible leaps. In a single year, he finished a 2-year program at the Louisville College of Pharmacy and won the gold medal for best student. He began working for his older brother Jacob, another druggist who also had a microscope. Now Simon did not have to sneak to use it. Simultaneously, he went to a medical school, at night. Flexner later recalled, "I never made a physical examination. I never heard a heart or lung sound." But he did get an MD. His younger brother Abraham had graduated from the Hopkins, and Simon sent some of his microscopic observations to Welch. Soon, Simon was studying at the Hopkins himself. Welch took to him, though they were opposites. Flexner was small and wiry, almost wizened, and no one ever called him charming. He had an edgy insecurity and said, "I have never been educated in any branch of learning. There are great gaps in my knowledge." To fill the gaps, he read. He read, his brother Abraham said, as he ate. He devoured books, read everything, read omnivorously, from English literature to Huxley and Darwin. He felt he had to learn. His insecurities never fully left him. He talked of sleepless nights and days of acute fear, a maddening nervousness which prevented me from having a quiet moment. Yet others recognized in him extraordinary possibilities. Welch arranged a fellowship for him in Germany, and 4 years later he became professor of pathology at the Hopkins. Often he went into the field, to a mining town to study meningitis, to the Philippines to study dysentery, to Hong Kong to study plague. Nobel laureate Peyton Rouse later called Flexner's scientific papers a museum in print, only they stir with life. For he experimented as well as described. He never lost his street toughness, but his sharp, hard edges did become rounded. He married a woman who was herself extraordinary enough to captivate Bertrand Russell. 60 letters from him were in her papers, and whose sister was a founder of Bryn Mawr. The famed jurist Learned Hand became a close friend, and he left his mark on the Rockefeller Institute. Emerson said that an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man, and the Institute did reflect Simon Flexner. Raymond Fosdick, later president of the Rockefeller Foundation, talked of the steely precision of his reason. His mind was like a searchlight that could be turned at will on any question that came before him. A Rockefeller researcher said he had a logic far beyond that of most men, final as a knife. But in place of the comfort and monastic purpose and intimacy that Welch gave the Hopkins, Flexner made Rockefeller sharp, edgy, cold. Once, when the usefulness ended of horses that had been immunized against a disease, then bled over and over to produce antiserum, he never considered turning them out to pasture. He considered only either selling them for slaughter to manufacturers, or they can be bled further, with the idea of sacrificing them, bleeding them to death for a final harvest of serum. He could dismiss a person as easily, ridding the Institute of what he termed unoriginal men as soon as he made that determination. The room most feared in the Institute was Flexner's office. He could be brutal there, and several prominent scientists were afraid of him. Even at Flexner's memorial service, a Nobel laureate said, "Individuals were as nothing to Dr. Flexner compared with the welfare of the Institute." He sought attention for the Institute from the press and credit from the scientific community. His own work created controversy. Shortly after the Rockefeller Institute was established, a meningitis epidemic struck the eastern United States. Desperate measures were used to fight the infection. Diphtheria antitoxin was tried, and some physicians even tried the ancient practice of bleeding patients. At the Hopkins, Cushing tried draining pus-filled fluid from the spinal canal. At the Rockefeller Institute, the meningitis epidemic seemed a particular challenge. Rockefeller and Gates wanted results. Flexner wanted to produce them. 10 years earlier, William Park, who had perfected diphtheria antitoxin, had developed a serum against meningococci. In every laboratory test, his serum had worked. But it had had no effect on people. Now, two Germans developed a similar serum, but they injected it directly into the spinal column instead of into veins or muscle. Normally, the mortality rate from the disease was 80%. In 102 patients, they cut the mortality to 67%, suggestive but not a statistically significant improvement. Still, Flexner's instincts told him it meant something. He repeated the German experiments. His patients died at a 75% rate. Instead of discarding the approach, however, he persisted. He began a long series of experiments, both in the laboratory, to improve the serum's potency, and physiologically, searching for the best way to administer it to monkeys. After 3 years of work, he settled upon the method. First, to insert a needle intrathecally, under a thin membrane lining the spinal cord, and withdraw 50 cc's of spinal fluid, and then to inject 30 cc's of serum. Unless fluid was withdrawn first, the injection could increase pressure and cause paralysis. It worked. In 712 people, the mortality rate fell to 31.4%. Physicians from Boston, San Francisco, Nashville, all confirmed the work, with one noting, remarkable results were obtained in the use of this serum by the country practitioners. Not all accepted Flexner's role. Later, in a bacteriology textbook, Park implied that Flexner had contributed little to the development of the serum. Flexner responded with an angry visit to Park's lab. A shouting match ensued. There would be further disputes between the two, public enough that newspapers reported on one. Ultimately, Flexner cut the death rate for patients infected by the meningococcus, the most common cause of bacterial meningitis, to 18%. According to a recent New England Journal of Medicine study, today, with antibiotics, patients at Massachusetts General Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the world, suffering from bacterial meningitis, have a mortality rate of 25%. He and the Institute received massive amounts of publicity. He liked it and wanted more. So did Gates and Rockefeller. In the first decade of the Institute especially, whenever someone there seemed on the edge of something exciting, Flexner hovered about. His constant attention seemed to demand results, and he routinely urged investigators to publish, writing, for example, "In view of the rapidity with which publications are appearing from Belgium and France, I advise the publication of your present results. Please see me about this promptly." The pressure did not all come from Flexner. It simply flowed down through him. At a 1914 dinner, Gates declared, "Who has not felt the throbbing desire to be useful to the whole wide world? The discoveries of this institute have already reached the depths of Africa with their healing ministrations. You announce a discovery here. Before night, your discovery will be flashed around the world. In 30 days, it will be in every medical college on earth." The result was a publicity machine. Highly respected investigators mocked the Institute for, said one who himself spent time there, frequent ballyhoo of unimportant stuff as the work of genius, because of administrators and directors impelled by the desire for institutional advertising. Yet Flexner also had a large vision. In his own work, he had what Welch lacked, the ability to ask a large question and frame it in ways that made answering it achievable. And when he judged an investigator original, an asset to the Institute, he gave his full support. He did so with Nobel laureates Alexis Carrel and Carl Landsteiner, both of whose work was recognized early, but he also gave freedom and support to young investigators who had not yet made their mark. Peyton Rouse, whose undergraduate and medical degrees both came from the Hopkins, would win the Nobel Prize for his discovery that a virus could cause cancer. He made that finding in 1911. The prize did not come until 1966. Initially, the scientific community mocked him. It took that long for his work first to be confirmed, then appreciated. Yet Flexner always stood by him. Thomas Rivers, a Hopkins-trained scientist at Rockefeller who defined the difference between viruses and bacteria, recalled, "I am not saying Flexner wasn't tough or couldn't be mean. He could, believe me, but he also was tender with people." Even in a formal report to the Board of Scientific Directors, thinking of Rouse, perhaps, or perhaps Paul Lewis, an extraordinarily promising young scientist working directly with Flexner, Flexner said, "The ablest men are often the most diffident and self-deprecatory. They require in many cases to be reassured and made to believe in themselves." When another scientist Flexner had faith in wanted to switch fields, Flexner told him, "It will take 2 years for you to find your way. I won't expect anything from you until after that." And finally, Flexner believed in openness. He welcomed disagreement, expected friction and interaction, wanted the Institute to become a living thing. The lunchroom was as important to Flexner as the laboratory. There, colleagues working in different areas exchanged ideas. Rouse was a brilliant conversationalist. Jacques Loeb, Carrel, recalled Michael Heidelberger, then a junior investigator. Although Rouse and Carrel won the Nobel Prize, Loeb may have been the most provocative. These were really remarkable sessions sometimes. They were a great inspiration. Each Friday especially mattered. Investigators routinely presented their most recent work in a casual setting, and colleagues made comments, suggested experiments, added different contexts. It was a place of excitement, of near holiness, even though some men, Carl Landsteiner, for instance, another Nobel laureate, almost never made presentations. Flexner actively sought out individualists who did not fit in elsewhere, whether they be loners or prima donnas. The mix was what mattered. Flexner, Rouse said, made the Institute an organism, not an establishment. And Flexner's impact, like Welch's, was extending far beyond anything he did personally in the laboratory, or for that matter, in the Rockefeller Institute itself. Even before the Institute had exerted wide influence, American medical science was attaining world class. In 1908, the International Congress on Tuberculosis was held in Washington. Robert Koch came from Germany, great and imperious, prepared to pass judgment and issue decrees. At a meeting of the Section on Pathology and Bacteriology, which Welch headed, Park read a paper stating that it is now absolutely established that quite a number of children have contracted fatal generalized tuberculosis from bacilli in cow's milk. Koch insisted Park was wrong, that no evidence supported the idea that cattle gave tuberculosis to man. Theobald Smith then rose and supported Park. Arguments broke out all over the room. But the Congress as a whole was convinced. A few days later, it passed a resolution calling for preventive measures against the spread of tuberculosis from cattle to man. Koch snapped, "Gentlemen, you may pass your resolutions, but posterity will decide." One delegate noted, "Dr. Koch isolated the tubercle bacillus. Today, science isolated Dr. Koch." Science is not democratic. Votes do not matter. Yet this vote marked the coming of age of American medicine. It was by no means due solely to the Hopkins. Neither Park nor Smith had trained or taught there. But the Hopkins and the Rockefeller Institute were about to fit two more pieces into place that would give American medicine a true claim to scientific leadership. Chapter 5. The men who created the Rockefeller Institute always intended to have a small affiliated hospital built to investigate disease. No patient would pay for treatment, and only those suffering from diseases being studied would be admitted. No other research institute in the world had such a facility. That much, William Welch, Simon Flexner, Frederick Gates, and John D. Rockefeller Jr. did intend. But they did not plan to have what Rufus Cole, the hospital's first director, all but forced upon them. Tall, mustached, and elegant, with an ancestor who arrived at Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1633, Cole did not appear to be a forceful man, did not seem someone capable of confronting Flexner. But he always remained true to those things that he had thought out, and his thinking was powerful. Then he yielded only to evidence, not to personality, and advanced his own ideas calmly and with tenacity. His longtime colleague Thomas Rivers called him a modest man, a rather timid man, who would go out of his way to dodge a confrontation. But, Rivers added, he was considered the brightest man that ever graduated from Hopkins at the time he graduated. If you get him mad, get him in a corner and kind of back him up, you would find, generally to your sorrow, that the old boy wasn't afraid to fight. Cole had wide interests and late in life wrote a two-volume, 1,294-page study of Oliver Cromwell, the Stuarts, and the English Civil War. But at the Institute lunch table, he focused. Heidelberger recalled he would sit there and listen to whatever was going on, and then he'd ask a question. Sometimes the question seemed almost naive for a person who was supposed to know as much as he did, but the result always was to bring out things that hadn't been brought out before, and to get much deeper down into the problem than one had before. Dr. Cole was really quite remarkable in that way. His father and two uncles were doctors, and at the Hopkins, his professor Llewellyn Barker had established laboratories next to patient wards to study disease, not just conduct diagnostic tests. There, Cole had done pioneering research. He came away from that experience with ideas that would influence the conduct of clinical research. Research using patients instead of test tubes or animals to this day. Flexner saw the hospital as a testing ground for ideas generated by laboratory scientists. The scientists would control experimental therapies. The doctors treating the patients would do little more than play the role of a technician caring for a lab animal. Cole had other ideas. He would not allow the hospital and its doctors to serve, said Rivers, as a handmaiden. He and his boys were not going to test Noguchi's ideas, Meltzer's ideas, or Levins's ideas. Cole was adamant that people caring for patients do the research on them. In a letter to the directors, Cole explained that the clinicians should be full-fledged scientists conducting serious research. One thing that has most seriously delayed the advancement of medicine has been the physical and intellectual barrier between the laboratory and the wards of many of our hospitals. Clinical laboratories most often exist merely to aid diagnosis. I would therefore urge that the hospital laboratory be developed as a true research laboratory, and that, moreover, the doctors of the hospital be permitted and urged to undertake experimental work. This was no simple question of turf or bureaucratic power. Cole was setting an enormously important precedent. He was calling for, demanding, that physicians treating patients undertake rigorous research involving patients with disease. Precedents for this kind of work had been seen elsewhere, but not in the systematic way Cole envisioned. Such studies not only threatened the power of the scientists doing purely laboratory research at the Institute, but, by implication, also changed the doctor-patient relationship. They were an admission that doctors did not know the answers and could not learn them without the patient's help. Since any rigorous study required a control, this also meant that random chance, as opposed to the best judgment of the physician, might dictate what treatment a patient got. Timid of nature or not, Cole would not yield. Flexner did. As a result, the Rockefeller Institute Hospital applied science directly to patient care, creating the model of clinical research. A model followed today by the greatest medical research facility in the world, the Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. That model allowed investigators to learn. It also prepared them to act. The Rockefeller Institute Hospital opened in 1910. By then, the best of American medical science and education could compete with the best in the world. But an enormous gap existed in the United States between the best medical practice and the average, and an unbridgeable chasm separated the best from the worst. In effect, there were outstanding generals, colonels, and majors, but they had no sergeants, corporals, or privates. They had no army to lead, at least not a reliable one. The gap between the best and the average had to be closed, and the worst had to be eliminated. Physicians already practicing were unreachable. They had on their own either chosen to adopt scientific methods or not. Thousands had. Simon Flexner himself received his MD from a terrible medical school, but had more than compensated, confirming Welch's observation, the results were better than the system. But the system of medical education still needed massive reform. Calls for reform had begun in the 1820s. Little had been accomplished outside a handful of elite schools. Even among elite schools, change came slowly. Not until 1901 did Harvard, followed soon by Penn and Columbia, join the Hopkins in requiring medical students to have a college degree. But even the best schools failed to follow the Hopkins's lead in recruiting quality faculty, instead choosing professors in clinical medicine from among local physicians. The official history of Penn's medical school conceded, inbreeding of a faculty could hardly go farther. Harvard's clinical professors were actually selected by a group of doctors who had no status at Harvard and met at the Tavern Club to make their decisions, which were usually based on seniority. Not until 1912 would Harvard select a clinical professor from outside this group. Pressure did come from within the profession to improve. Not only those at the Hopkins, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Harvard, and other leading medical schools devoted themselves to reform. So did a large number of individual physicians and surgeons. In 1904, the American Medical Association finally formed a council on medical education to organize the reform movement. The council began inspecting all 162 medical schools, more than half of all the medical schools in the world, in the United States and Canada. 3 years later, the AMA Council issued a blistering, but confidential report. It concluded that at the better schools, improvement was occurring, although, despite enormous effort by many reformers, not at a rapid enough pace. But the worst schools had barely changed at all. Faculty still owned most of them. Most still had no connection to a university or a hospital and no standards for admission, and tuition still funded faculty salaries. One school had graduated 105 doctors in 1905, none of whom had completed any laboratory work whatsoever. They had not dissected a single cadaver, nor had they seen a single patient. They would wait for a patient to enter their office for that experience. The report had some effect. Within a year, 57 medical schools were requiring at least 1 year of college of their applicants. But that still left two-thirds of the schools with lower or no requirements, and it did not address the content of the education itself. Unable to confront its own membership again, in 1900, the AMA had only 8,000 members out of 110,000 doctors and feared antagonizing the profession. The AMA gave its report to the Carnegie Foundation, insisted that it remain confidential, and asked for help. In turn, the Carnegie Foundation commissioned Simon Flexner's brother Abraham to survey medical education. Although not a doctor, Flexner had been an undergraduate at the Hopkins. He said that even among undergraduates, research was the air we breathed, and it already demonstrated both a ruthless, unforgiving judgment and a commitment to advancing model educational institutions. In his first job after college, he had taught in a Louisville high school, where he failed his entire class of 15 students, and had experimented with new ways of teaching. Later, he would create the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton and personally recruit Albert Einstein to it. Abraham Flexner began his study by talking at length to Welch and Franklin Moll. Their views influenced him, to say the least. He stated, "The rest of my study of medical education was little more than an amplification of what I had learned during my initial visit to Baltimore." In 1910, the same year the Rockefeller Institute Hospital opened, his report, Medical Education in the United States and Canada, appeared. It soon came to be known simply as the Flexner Report. According to it, very, very few schools met his standards, or any reasonable standard. He dismissed many schools as without redeeming features of any kind. General squalor, clinical poverty. One encounters surgery taught without patient, instrument, model, or drawing. Recitations in obstetrics without a mannequin in sight, often without one in the building. At Temple, at Halifax University, at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathy, the dissecting rooms defy description. The smell is intolerable, the cadavers now putrid. At North Carolina Medical College, Flexner quoted a faculty member saying, "It is idle to talk of real laboratory work for students so ignorant and clumsy. Many of them, gotten through advertising, would make better farmers." Flexner concluded that more than 120 of the 150-plus medical schools in operation should be closed. It was the progressive era. Life was becoming organized, rationalized, specialized. In every field, professionals were emerging, routing the ideas of the Jacksonian period when state legislatures deemed that licensing even physicians was anti-democratic. Frederick Taylor was creating the field of scientific management to increase efficiencies in factories, and Harvard Business School opened in 1908 to teach it. This rationalization of life included national advertising, which was now appearing, and retail chains, which were stretching across the continent. United Drug Stores, the largest, had 6,843 locations. But the Flexner Report did not merely reflect the progressive era, nor did it reflect the context in which one Marxist historian tried to place scientific medicine, calling it a tool developed by members of the medical profession and the corporate class to legitimize capitalism and shift attention from social causes of disease. Non-capitalist societies, including Japan, Russia, and China, were adopting scientific medicine as well. The report reflected less the progressive era than science. Not surprisingly, progressives failed in a similar effort to standardize training of lawyers. Anyone could read a statute. Only a trained specialist could isolate a pathogen from someone sick. The progressive era was, however, also the muckraking era. Flexner's report raked muck and created a sensation. 15,000 copies were printed. Newspapers headlined it and investigated local medical schools. Flexner received at least one death threat. The impact was immediate. Armed now with the outcry Flexner had generated, the AMA's Council on Medical Education began rating schools as Class A and fully satisfactory, Class B, which were redeemable, or Class C, which were needing complete reorganization. Schools owned and operated by faculty were automatically rated C. Less than 4 years after Flexner's report was issued, 31 states denied licensing recognition to new graduates of Class C institutions, effectively killing the schools outright. Class B schools had to improve or merge. Medical schools at such universities as Nebraska, Colorado, Tufts, George Washington, and Georgetown kept a tenuous hold on AMA approval, but survived. In Baltimore, three Class B schools consolidated into the present University of Maryland Medical School. In Atlanta, Emory absorbed two other schools. Medical schools at such institutions as Southern Methodist, Drake, Bowdoin, and Fordham simply collapsed. By the late 1920s, before the economic pressure of the Depression, nearly 100 medical schools had closed or merged. The number of medical students, despite a dramatic increase in the country's population, declined from 28,000 in 1904 to fewer than 14,000 in 1920. In 1930, despite a further increase in the country's population, the number of medical students was still 25% less than in 1904. Later, Arthur Dean Bevin, leader of the AMA reform effort, insisted the AMA deserved practically all the credit for the reorganization of medical education in this country. 80% of the Flexner Report was taken from the work of the Council on Medical Education. Bevin was wrong. The AMA wanted to avoid publicity, but only the leverage of the publicity. Indeed, the scandal Flexner generated could force change. Without the report, reform would have taken years, perhaps decades. And Flexner influenced the direction of change as well. He defined a model. The model for the schools that survived was, of course, the Johns Hopkins. Flexner's report had indirect impact as well. It greatly accelerated the flow, already begun, of philanthropic funds into medical schools. Between 1902 and 1934, 9 major foundations poured $154 million into medicine, nearly half the total funds given away to all causes. And this understates the money generated, because the gifts often required the school to raise matching funds. This money saved some schools. Yale, for example, was rated a weak Class B school, but it launched a fundraising drive and increased its endowment from $300,000 to almost $3 million. Its operating budget leaped from $43,000 to $225,000. The states also began pouring money into schools of state universities. The largest single donor remained the Rockefeller Foundation. John D. Rockefeller himself continued to see a homeopathic physician. Welch had turned the Hopkins model into a force. He and colleagues at Michigan, at Penn, at Harvard, and at a handful of other schools had, in effect, first formed an elite group of senior officers of an army. Then, in an amazingly brief time, they had revolutionized American medicine, created and expanded the officer corps, and begun training their army, an army of scientists and scientifically grounded physicians. On the eve of America's entry into World War I, Welch had one more goal. In 1884, when the Hopkins first offered Welch his position, he had urged the establishment of a separate school to study public health in a scientific manner. Public health was and is where the largest numbers of lives are saved, usually by understanding the epidemiology of a disease, its patterns, where and how it emerges and spreads, and attacking it at its weak points. This usually means prevention. Science had first contained smallpox, then cholera, then typhoid, then plague, then yellow fever, all through large-scale public health measures. Everything from filtering water to testing and killing rats to vaccination. Public health measures lack the drama of pulling someone back from the edge of death, but they save lives by the millions. Welch had put that goal aside while he focused on transforming American medicine, on making it science-based. Now he began to pursue that goal again, suggesting to the Rockefeller Foundation that it fund a school of public health. There was competition to get this institution, and others tried to convince the foundation that though creating a school of public health made good sense, putting it in Baltimore did not. In 1916, Harvard President Charles Eliot wrote bluntly to the foundation, and simultaneously paid Welch a supreme compliment, when he dismissed the entire Hopkins Medical School as one man's work in a new and small university. "The more I consider the project of placing the Institute of Hygiene at Baltimore, the less suitable expedient I find it. In comparison with either Boston or New York, it conspicuously lacks public spirit and beneficent community action. The personality and career of Dr. Welch are the sole argument for putting it in Baltimore, and he is almost 66 years old and will have no similar successor. Nonetheless, that sole argument sufficed. The Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health was scheduled to open October 1, 1918. Welch had resigned as a professor at the medical school to be its first dean. The study of epidemic disease is, of course, a prime focus of public health. Welch was sick the day of the scheduled opening and getting sicker. He had recently returned from a trip to investigate a strange and deadly epidemic. His symptoms were identical to those of the victims of that epidemic, and he believed he, too, had the disease. The army Welch had created was designed to attack, to seek out particular targets, if only targets of opportunity, and kill them. On October 1, 1918, the abilities of that army were about to be tested by the deadliest epidemic in human history. Part 2. The Swarm. Chapter 6. Haskell County, Kansas, lies west of Dodge City, where cattle drives up from Texas reached a railhead, and belongs geographically to, and in 1918, not far in time from, the truly Wild West. The landscape was and is flat and treeless, and the county was literally of the earth. Sod houses built of earth were still common then, and even one of the county's few post offices was located in the dugout sod home of the postmaster, who once a week collected the mail by riding his horse 40 miles round trip to the county seat in Santa Fe, a smattering of a few wooden buildings that was already well on its way to becoming the ghost town it would be in another 10 years. Today only its cemetery remains as a sign of its existence. But other towns nearby did have life. In Copeland, Stebbins Cash Store sold groceries, shoes, dry goods, dishes, hardware, implements, paints, and oils, while in Sublet, in the absence of a bank, S.E. Cave loaned money on real estate for 7.5%. Here, land, crops, and livestock were everything, and the smell of manure meant civilization. Farmers lived in close proximity to hogs and fowl, with cattle, pigs, and poultry everywhere. There were plenty of dogs, too, and owners made sure to teach their dogs not to chase someone else's cattle. That could get them shot. It was a land of extremes. It was dry enough that the bed of the Cimarron River often lay cracked and barren of water. Dry enough that the front page of the local newspaper proclaimed in February 1918, a slow rain fell all day, measuring 27 one-hundredths. It was well appreciated. Yet torrential rains sometimes brought floods, such as the one in 1914 that drowned ranchers and wiped out the first and largest permanent business in the area, a ranch that ran 30,000 head of cattle. In summer, the sun bleached the prairie, parching it under a heat that made light itself quiver. In winter, unearthly gales swept unopposed across the plains for hundreds of miles, driving the wind chill past 50 degrees below zero. Then the country seemed as frozen and empty as the Russian steppes. And storms, violent storms, from tornadoes to literally blinding blizzards, plagued the region. But all these extremes of nature came every season. Another extreme of nature came only once. Epidemiological evidence suggests that a new influenza virus originated in Haskell County, Kansas, early in 1918. Evidence further suggests that this virus traveled east across the state to a huge army base, and from there to Europe. Later it began its sweep through North America, through Europe, through South America, through Asia and Africa, through isolated islands in the Pacific, through all the wide world. In its wake followed a keening sound that rose from the throats of mourners like the wind. The evidence comes from Dr. Loring Minor. Loring Minor was an unusual man. A graduate of the oldest university in the West, Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, a classicist enamored of ancient Greece, he had come in 1885 to this region. Despite a background so unlike those of his fellow frontiersmen, he had taken to the country and done well. Minor was a big man in many ways. Physically large, with angular features and a handlebar mustache. Gruff, someone who didn't suffer fools, especially when he drank, which was often. A certain rebelliousness was part of his bigness as well. He hadn't seen the inside of a church in years. Periodically, he reread the classics in Greek, but he ate peas with his knife. And in 30 years on that prairie, he had built a small empire apart from medicine. In the Odd Fellows, he was a past noble grand. He had shared the county Democratic Party, had been county coroner, was county health officer. He owned a drugstore and grocery and expected his patients to buy from him, and he married into the family of the largest landowners in western Kansas. Even in Haskell there was a social order, and now, during the war, his wife used her social standing as head of the county Red Cross Woman's Work Committee. When she asked for something, few said no to her, and most women in the county did Red Cross work. Real work. Hard work. Almost as hard as farm work. But Minor also personified Welch's comment that the results of medical education were better than the system. Although an isolated country doctor who began practicing before the establishment of the germ theory of disease, he had quickly accepted it, kept up with the astounding advances in his profession, built a laboratory in his office, learned how to use the new antitoxins for diphtheria and tetanus. By 1918, one of his sons had also become a doctor with a fully scientific education and was already in the Navy. He prided himself on his own scientific knowledge and puzzled over problems. His patients said they'd rather have him drunk than someone else sober. His practice ranged over hundreds of square miles. Perhaps that was what Minor liked about it, the great expanse, the extremes, the lonely wind that could turn as violent as a gunshot, the hours spent making his way to a patient, sometimes in a horse and buggy, sometimes by car, sometimes by train. Conductors would hold the train for him, and in winter, station masters would violate the rules and let him wait inside the office by the stove. But in late January and early February 1918, Minor had other concerns. One patient presented with what seemed common symptoms, although with unusual intensity. Violent headache and body aches, high fever, non-productive cough. Then another, and another. In Satanta, in Sublette, in Santa Fe, in Jean, in Copeland, on isolated farms. Minor had seen influenza often. He diagnosed the disease as influenza. But he had never seen influenza like this. This was violent, rapid in its progress through the body, and sometimes lethal. This influenza killed. Soon, dozens of his patients, the strongest, the healthiest, the most robust people in the county, were being struck down as suddenly as if they had been shot. Minor turned all his energies to this disease. He drew blood, urine and sputum samples, and used the laboratory skills his son had helped him improve. He searched all his medical texts and journals. He called his few colleagues in that part of the state. He contacted the U.S. Public Health Service, which offered him neither assistance nor advice. Meanwhile, he likely did what little he could, trying diphtheria antitoxin with no effect, perhaps even trying tetanus antitoxin. Anything that might stimulate the body's immune system against disease. The local paper, the Santa Fe Monitor, apparently worried about hurting morale in wartime, said little about deaths, but on inside pages reported, Mrs. Eva Van Alston is sick with pneumonia. Her little son Roy is now able to get up. Ralph Lindemann is still quite sick. Goldie Volgehagen is working at the Beeman store during her sister Eva's sickness. Homer Moody has been reported quite sick. Merton, the young son of Ernest Elliot, is sick with pneumonia. We are pleased to report that Pete Hesser's children are recovering nicely. Mrs. J. S. Cox is some better, but is very weak yet. Ralph McConnell has been quite sick this week. By now, the disease overwhelmed Minor with patience. He pushed everything else aside, slept sometimes in his buggy while the horse made its own way home, one advantage over the automobile, through frozen nights. Perhaps he wondered if he was being confronted with the plague of Athens, a mysterious disease that devastated the city during the Peloponnesian Wars, killing possibly one-third the population. Then, the disease disappeared. By mid-March, the schools reopened with healthy children. Men and women returned to work, and the war regained its hold on people's thoughts. The disease still, however, troubled Minor deeply. It also frightened him, not only for his own people, but for the people beyond. Influenza was neither a reportable disease, not a disease that the law required physicians to report, nor a disease that any state or federal public health agency tracked. Yet Minor considered his experience so unusual, and this eruption of the disease so dangerous, that he formally warned national public health officials about it. Public Health Reports was a weekly journal published by the U.S. Public Health Service to alert health officials to outbreaks of all communicable diseases, not only in North America and Europe, but anywhere in the world. In Saigon, Bombay, Madagascar, Quito. It tracked not just deadly diseases such as yellow fever and plague, but far lesser threats. Especially in the United States, it tracked mumps, chickenpox, and measles. In the first 6 months of 1918, Minor's warning of influenza of severe type was the only reference in that journal to influenza anywhere in the world. Other medical journals that spring carried articles on influenza outbreaks, but they all occurred after Haskell's, and they were not issued as public health warnings. Haskell County remains the first outbreak in 1918, suggesting that a new influenza virus was adapting, violently, to man. As it turned out, the death rate in Haskell as a percentage of the entire county's population was only a fraction of what the death rate for the United States would be later that year, when influenza struck in full force. People suffering from influenza shed virus, expel viruses that can infect others, for usually no more than 7 days after infection, and often even less. After that, although they may continue to cough and sneeze, they will not spread the disease. As sparsely populated and isolated as Haskell was, the virus infecting the county might well have died there, might well have failed to spread to the outside world. That would be so, except for one thing. This was wartime. The same week that Homer Moody and a dozen others in Jean, Kansas, fell ill, a young soldier named Dean Nilsen came home to Jean on leave from Camp Funston, located 300 miles away within the vast Fort Riley Military Reservation. The Santa Fe Monitor noted, "Dean looks like soldier life agrees with him." After his leave, of course, he returned to the camp. Ernest Elliott left Sublette in Haskell County to visit his brother at Funston just as his child fell ill. By the time Elliott returned home, the child had pneumonia. Of nearby Copeland on February 21st, the paper said, "Most everybody over the country is having la grippe or pneumonia." On February 28th, it reported that John Bottom just left Copeland for Funston. "We predict John will make an ideal soldier." Camp Funston, the second largest cantonment in the country, held on average 56,000 green young troops. The camp was built at the confluence of the Smoky Hill and Republican Rivers, where they form the Kansas River. Like all the other training camps in the country, Funston had been thrown together in literally a few weeks in 1917. There, the Army prepared young men for war. It was a typical camp, with typical tensions between Army regulars and men who had until recently been civilians. When Major John Donnelly was stopped by military police for speeding, for example, he defended himself to the commanding general. I have, on a few occasions, corrected enlisted personnel along the road parallel to that camp for failure to salute. Cases that I could not conscientiously overlook, there being no excuse whatever for their failure to do so. This, like my attempted correction of this guard, may not have been taken in the proper spirit, resulting in a feeling of insubordinate revenge and animosity towards me by members of this organization. There were also the usual clashes of egos, especially since Camp Funston and Fort Riley had different commanding officers. These clashes ended when Major General C.G. Ballou, who commanded the cantonment, sent a missive to Washington. He had developed what he described as a training ground for specialists at Smoky Hill Flat. In fact, Smoky Hill Flat was the best of three polo fields on the base. The commanding officer of Fort Riley, only a colonel, established the post dump beside it. The general requested and received authority to exercise command over the entire reservation of Fort Riley, and the colonel was relieved of his command. Funston was typical in another way. The winter of 1917 to 18 was one of record cold, and as the army itself conceded, at Funston as elsewhere, barracks and tents were overcrowded and inadequately heated, and it was impossible to supply the men with sufficient warm clothing. So army regulations, written for health reasons, detailing how much space each man should have, were violated, and men were stacked in bunks with insufficient clothing and bedding and inadequate heating. That forced them to huddle ever more closely together around stoves.